Welcome to State of the News. I'm Rick Hellett, and we begin this hour with our usual review and sometimes look ahead at Metro News. Our roundtable of WFPL reporters is here. Gabe Bullard, Erica Peterson, Philip M. Bailey, and Devin Katayama. Welcome back, all.
Hi.
Hi. Good to be here.
Hey. So you've survived the week. We want to hear from you, have some thoughts about the, perhaps the U of L healthcare merger, the Judy Green removal case, the redrawing of Metro Council districts, or other news topics. Give us a call, 502-814-TALK, or toll-free 1-877-814-TALK. That's 8255. You can email us at news@WFPL.org. Send us a tweet if you like. We're at WFPL News, or you can visit us on Facebook. A little later, we're going to be talking about the November general election and the race for Kentucky governor and other statewide offices. Also, instant racing will be a topic of discussion a little later. And Carrie Stimley of Leo Weekly is going to come in, talk about a Kentucky artist who has admitted to claiming the work of another artist as his own. It's the focus of a cover article in Leo this week. Well, let's start with Gabe Bullard. Gabe, lots of questions swirling around how certain procedures that would be banned under Catholic doctrine under this big hospital merger involving U of L and Catholic health initiatives, and officials were trying to answer at least one of those questions this week.
Right. There have been a lot of questions about how services or medical procedures that are banned under Catholic directives but still legal under U.S. law would be handled in this merger at University Hospital. The big question was around tubal ligations or tube tying for women. A lot of women opt to have those after a cesarean section to avoid what could be another dangerous pregnancy or a dangerous surgery. And that's not allowed. Any sort of sterilization isn't allowed under the care doctrines. So this week, the principals in the merger announced that they will be moving those procedures from University Hospital to Baptist Hospital East. It will be U of L doctors being trained there. The medical school is not merging, so the doctors are free to perform any procedures that are legal. So they'll still be training out there. There may even be some more OBGYNs being trained under this.
Now, what have been the complaints about this agreement?
Mainly that Baptist Hospital East is a long drive for away from University Hospital. Some people complain that there are a lot of women who would have to take the bus or who already do take the bus to University Hospital and now have to figure out a way to get out to Baptist Hospital East. The principals said this really won't cause much of a problem with emergency cesarean sections because state law requires a woman who wants to have a tubal ligation to give approval 24 hours before the procedure happens, at least 24 hours. So the way it usually works is a woman will plan to have a cesarean section or plan to have a standard birth and plan to have that surgery afterward. If it's a cesarean section, while the surgery is going on, the second procedure can be performed in the operating room there. And so there's not a lot of room for emergency procedures. It's not often the case that a woman would have to have that child. But in the case that it does happen, because it will happen and can happen, that a woman who has already decided to have a tubal ligation, who has already discussed it with her doctor at University Hospital, if there is an emergency situation and the baby would have to be delivered, she would have to be rushed to Baptist Hospital East. And that's caused a lot of the critics of the merger to say this does not solve the problem. This only creates an inconvenience for people rather than outright banning their services. There are a number of critics, some in the state legislature, some just out in the community, and there are a lot of people who are skeptical. The governor, the attorney general, Mayor Fisher have all expressed questions. None of them are really completely satisfied now that this decision has been made. It's not necessarily that they're not fans of the decision. They just say it's one question answered out of many. So they're still expecting a lot of other answers.
I'm curious, are there any women involved in these decisions?
There are always women at the press conferences, but it's usually men who speak most of the time. They do bring out the doctors who will explain parts of the procedures. But Hani Goldman, who's a PR professional in Louisville, who has actually been leading a lot of the criticisms here, she said, well, after the decision I talked to her, or after the announcement they were moving them to Baptist Hospital East, she said, obviously no one who did this has ever been in labor because they would not want to extend it the 15, 20 minutes, whatever it would take to get to Baptist Hospital East.
Any discussion at this point of having a Baptist Hospital East facility downtown?
No, and that's an interesting question because in other places, something like that has happened. The big examples that are often cited of a compromise between care and religious doctrine have been in Austin, where one floor of a hospital was essentially a separate hospital. It was just a women's clinic operated by a different entity, not under the Catholic doctrine. And in New York State, where a separate clinic was built outside of the hospital. There were some hints that that could be, that that could happen here in Louisville, or that possibly it was being considered back when these questions first started arising. The doctor said there's $15 million that will be set aside in this merger. That money could be used to renovate U of L facilities, which will not be part of the merger. It could be used to build new facilities. But they didn't say whether or not that was what they were considering. Now this $15 million will go toward enhancing that care at Baptist Hospital East, toward transportation for indigent women, and there are still a few questions to work out even with moving those procedures.
All right, thanks, Gabe. We'll come back to you in a moment. Let's turn to Philip M. Bailey, WFPL political editor. Wouldn't be Friday, Philip, without an update on the Judy Greene removal case, and there was another development yet again this week.
Yes, earlier this week, Greg Hovius, an attorney who represents the five members of the charging committee that impeached Councilwoman Greene, he filed a motion saying that Councilwoman Greene and her legislative aide have failed to comply with subpoenas that he filed over a month ago. The subpoenas are for emails and other documents related to the Green Clean Team and 100 Black Men, which were the center of the two ethics violations that were filed against Councilwoman Greene and that she was found by the Ethics Commission to have deliberately violated. Mr. Hovius says that in his motion, he asks either that Councilwoman Greene be compelled to turn over those documents, that her and her aide show evidence why they can't produce them, Or he asked and sought to have Councilman Greene removed immediately. Councilman Kelly Downard, who is the chair of the council court, which is the remaining members who will decide Councilman Greene's fate, he made his decision yesterday, essentially saying that he would not find Councilman Greene in default, that he's given her a new deadline to come up with these documents of September 6th, which is next Tuesday. If Councilman Greene does not turn those documents over relating to 100 Black Men and the Green Clean Team, she will not be able to use any of that information in her defense.
And so the removal hearing still, or the court-like hearing still set for September 12th?
Yeah, the expulsion trial is still scheduled for September 12th. It will involve the 20 members of the Metro Council who are on the court, and they will decide by a two-thirds vote whether to remove or to retain Councilman Greene in office.
We had a call from Greg. He couldn't stay with us, but he left a question. He says, if Judy Greene is removed, when would that happen? Well, September 12th, I guess, would be possibly that, or possibly, as you mentioned, some are calling for that to happen earlier. And who would take her place?
Well, the trial will last from September 12th to September 14th. After that, the council will deliberate in executive session, and they will make the decision there. if they vote by two-thirds, she would be removed immediately, meaning that her key card and her legislative aides, their access to the Metro Council would be taken from them. But she does have the right to appeal that decision to Jefferson Circuit Court. In the interim period, though, she will not be allowed, during the appeal, this is all speculation on if she is removed, she would not be allowed to sit in the committees or sit in council meetings and take votes. She would be considered no longer to be a member of the Metro Council, and it would be an appeal. After the 30 days, if she hasn't appealed, the council would then move forward and similar to when it replaced now deceased Councilman George Unsell, decided to replace him, they will go into the appointment process, which I think we are all pretty familiar with at this point. They've done it about three or four times, but that's all speculating that possibly if removal, that would require, of the 20, that would require 14 votes. So anything shy of 14, she would retain her seat.
I guess if she appeals, she could ask, not necessarily happen, but she could ask a judge to order that she remain in office?
Legally speaking, she could, I guess, ask for an injunction saying that she can't be removed from office. But once again, because it's uncharted territory, there is a bit of a hybrid here between the legislative process and how the council decides who is a member and who is not, and then involving the courts. I think that is one of the arguments I suspect that Durbin Webb, Councilman Greene's defense attorney in the removal trial, he will make, is that you have a convoluted process where the state law, the created merger, is flawed because it has a process for removing legislators that's just left up to the legislative body. At the same time, you later submit that process to the courts.
All right, Philip, thank you. We'll come back to you as well in a moment. We're going to stick with Metro Council news and turn to Devin Katayama. You've been looking into the progress of redrawing Louisville's Metro Council districts, which, of course, occurs after a census. There have been some meetings. There are some various maps floating around, but a little bit of confusion, it seems like.
Yeah, this week, earlier this week on Monday, there was a District 1 public meeting held, and it was unclear at the beginning of the week who exactly was holding this meeting or who put this meeting together. It turns out that Judy Greene's staff put this together. The staff weren't able to make it to the meeting, so her husband, James Greene, actually showed the public some of this information. And what this information showed was the proposed District 1 redistricting map and numbers to accompany it, which showed that there was going to be a drop in African-American population by about 20%. And it was unclear to us at the time exactly whether Metro Council endorsed this or not, but we did learn that Councilman Rick Blackwell was in attendance at that meeting, and some people in the public said that he did not contest any of the information that was being shown. So it seems like this was the second meeting, public meeting in that showing any kind of drafts for district maps. So I think the public is still waiting to see their specific areas. And we also learned this week, I spoke with Ken Fleming, the Republicans, and he said there was kind of a bipartisan agreement, unofficial agreement, that was going to wait until after the Judy Greene trial to mm-hmm. actually kind of show any more of these maps. I'm not quite sure if District 1 knew that information before they had the meeting, or whether they just went ahead and did it anyways.
Is there a deadline to have the maps redrawn?
At this point, the final deadline is the end of the year to have anything mm-hmm. really complete, but they seem to think that by October they should have a pretty good idea about what any recommendations they might make to Mayor Fisher.
Now, in the past, the council got the services of a University of Louisville geography professor, the late Bill Dakin. Have they enlisted someone else this time?
This time they're doing it. It's just all the ad hoc committee that's kind of working on it. Steve Hagg with the Republicans is doing all of the Republican redrawing. I spent an hour with him, I think yesterday, where he just sat me down and educated me about everything redistricting-wise. It was kind of overwhelming. He said that the Democrats he thinks that there's a few Democrats that are redrawing their lines, but for the Republicans, it's all Steve Hagg. To be honest, I think that the Democrats have a little harder time with what they're trying to deal with because of all the districts that touch other districts and the numbers that they have to comply with. So I think that's probably why they brought in a few more people. Judy Greene's husband, James Green, did speak with Michael Price, who works with the census data over at the U of L. I spoke with Michael as well earlier this week, and he says he hasn't been following the process much, but he says it was more informative from his perspective to hear what James Green was saying. And he acknowledges, like everyone else, that districts are going to have to change.
All right. Thank you, Devin. Let's turn to Erica Peterson, WFPL Environment Reporter. Erica, another air quality alert today. We just found out there's one tomorrow, and coincidentally, a big announcement today from the Obama administration regarding ozone.
Yeah, good timing, I guess, yeah. Or bad timing, however you look at it. But this is the 18th air quality alert we've had this year, and tomorrow will be the 19th. And last year, we just had 18 air quality alerts. So as of tomorrow, we have beat last year's record. And the air both today and tomorrow is officially in the red zone, which is unhealthy for everyone. And the announcement that came today from the Obama administration was, I think, a little bit of a surprise for a lot of people. The administration's been working on this whole host of rules to kind of reform the Clean Air Act. And that's what we've been hearing about. They've been putting out various pieces of that. There are some of them that are going to affect, say, power plants in the area. And they announced today that they were going to be backing down off of one of them, that they were going to not ask that Obama was asking the EPA to withdraw a proposed rule that would have tightened the ozone standards.
What reason did the administration give for doing this?
Well, all we have right now to go on is a press release. And in the press release, Obama said that he was definitely concerned about public health and the environment, but he kind of took a page from a lot of the Republican talking points we've been seeing, saying that he felt like the rules right now would create regulatory uncertainty and our economy's recovering. And so that was the reason he cited.
And there was a reaction. We do have some reaction from Senator McConnell, right?
Yeah, we do. Senator McConnell sent out a press release very quickly after it. And in, I guess, what a good politician can do is both praise something as well as beat down their opponent at the same time. And in his press release, he obviously is a fan of this move, but he talked about how this move highlights the devastating impact on jobs that's been created by Obama's regulatory overreach. So he's asking Obama to take similar steps back on other regulatory moves.
For those that don't know, when is an air quality alert issued, and what does that mean?
What it means is the city, the Air Pollution Control District, has a number of air monitors set around where they take actual readings of the air pollution in the air. But when they predict one for a day like, you know, tomorrow, what it means is that they've got a rubric that they use where the heat is going to be at a certain point. There's not going to be very much cloud cover. There's not going to be very much breeze. And basically, it just means the pollution is going to combine with the heat and the sunlight, stay close to the ground, and just create this, as you know, if you've been outside, this kind of gross mix that's kind of hard to breathe. And it's dangerous, you know, depending on the level, it's dangerous for various types of people.
And this zone is really, and they're saying this affects everyone.
They are.
Case.
Yeah, today and tomorrow, it's unhealthy for everyone. Usually, this is the first time this year we've seen air quality red days, which are unhealthy for everyone. Usually, it's unhealthy for sensitive groups, which means if you have breathing problems or if you're very old or very young, then it could be unhealthy for you.
All right. Well, the good news is the weather is supposed to change a little bit by about, what, Sunday or so. So we'll be out of the red zone.
Hopefully.
Hopefully. Enjoy the rest of the weekend. Thanks, Erica. Gabe Bullard, let's go back to you. There is an apparent agreement you have reported that will allow the Kentucky Opera to stage its performances. First one, Carmen, coming up with live musicians.
It's very close, according to General Director David Roth of the Opera. The Opera always traditionally uses Louisville Orchestra musicians because, unlike the ballet, which has opted to go to recorded music this year, the orchestra needs to have a live accompaniment. Having a conductor there really changes the performance, enhances the performance, and actually makes it go a lot smoother, it's my understanding. So without an agreement in place, the orchestra does not have a contract in place with the musicians for the next season. They've canceled orchestra concerts for this month and for next month. The deadline is coming up sometime soon, in the next week or so, most likely, for cancellations for further orchestra concerts. And so without that contract in place, the opera had no ready source of musicians. They went to the musicians' union in Louisville. They wanted to negotiate with the union and with the Louisville chapter of the union and tried to work out a deal. David Roth said the benefit here is that the union has rules for accompanying the opera. They have rules for accompanying a ballet, and so they were able to work out a tentative deal, something they hope they will be able to sign later today and announce later today that they have signed this agreement for live musicians following those union rules. He had promised initially when the orchestra concerts were canceled for this month and next month that there would be live musicians in the pit for Carmen. They need to start rehearsing by September 12th about, and they have performances scheduled on the 23rd and the 25th, and they have actually added an additional performance of Carmen for the 30th. Carmen, along with Madame Butterfly and a few others, Roth said, are among the most popular operas that are held and the ones that really draw the people out.
On a related note, you talk about still no contract between Louisville Orchestra musicians and management, and Mayor Fisher is going to be meeting with musicians today, correct?
He met with the musicians last week. He met with the management last Thursday. He said at that time that he would talk with the mediators, that he would try to get some more information and release a statement. Earlier this week, one of his spokesmen said that a statement would probably come out this week, yesterday or today, or it might come out early next week. At this point, I just talked with another member of the mayor's staff. It looks like there won't be a statement today. They're not saying there definitely won't be, but it looks like that's unlikely. The mayor's tied up with World Fest and preparing for the hike, bike, and paddle this weekend, and they said he's very busy and is unlikely to call the press in to release a statement or to write a statement and give an opinion. He's also possibly hoping for more information from the mediators in the party so he can try to put more out there.
I see. So the meetings have been held. We're waiting for the statement now.
Yeah, and it's not clear yet how many meetings, if any, he's had with the mediator, if he's talked with the mediator, if he's picked up this information that he had hoped to get before weighing in on it.
All right, very good. Devin Katayama, let's go back to you. You cover a lot of education issues for WFPL, and you checked in this week with Jefferson County Public Schools to see how the bus transportation system is working. Here we are a couple of weeks into the school year. The dust has settled a little bit, and how's it going?
Yeah, Director of JCPS Transportation, Rick Capel, says they are very close to the original goal that they mentioned at the beginning of the school year, which is trying to get all students off the bus by around 5 o'clock. There's about 100 students on Tuesday that were still on the bus after five, and he says that's pretty, to use his words, pretty darn good. And early childhood busing also started to this week, so there's going to be 5,000 more 3 and 4 year olds that are on the roads starting this week as well. But yeah, they seem to be thinking that this is a pretty successful start to the school year. And, you know, there's about 66,000 students that are now going to be bused every day. So they think it's pretty successful.
And how many buses are there on the roads?
There's about 960 JCPS buses, which, I mean, I every day I drive to work, I see at least three of them. Mm-hmm. I don't know what exactly if they're coming or going, but they're usually pretty empty. So I don't know. I don't know what the deal is.
Of course, that's been the focus of a lot of attention this year because there were some major problems with the first day of school last year.
Right, and so that was a very closely watched issue, and I think important to a lot of parents and a lot of community members.
All right, now over to you, Philip. You reported this week that Metro Councilwoman Vicki Aubrey-Welch has amended her proposed ordinance that would require certain children to wear life jackets at certain locations, watering holes.
Yes, Councilwoman Welch, she introduced this ordinance off the idea that we had seen a number of children drown at area waterways. The original ordinance had to deal with children who were in or around public waterways, creeks, rivers, things of that nature, and that they would by law, have to wear a life preserver if they were 12 or younger. After talking with some officials from Waterfront Park, from 21st Century Parks, and Metro Parks, Councilman Welch decided to amend that ordinance slightly this week. Now it's for navigable waterways. The exemption obviously would be given to places, certain facilities like the Belle of Louisville or Jefferson City Star. So what we see here is that Councilman Welch, after initially meeting that criticism, I think understood that there were some worries about how broad the law was. For example, some Republicans had brought up the point of, what if your child is, you know, along Waterfront Park, you're just walking with them, are they required to wear a life preserver? She still says the focus should be on protecting children in this situation, but that she certainly was willing to work with and compromise and amend that ordinance slightly. Obviously, that will be, I don't know if it passed committee, but I know the amendment passed changing the law, so that will be debated in the Public Safety Committee at this next meeting.
I guess there's been some concern about what these devices would cost them.
Yes, that was another concern that Republicans and others had, which is the cost. Life preservers come in three different categories, according to the U.S. Coast Guard. The ones we're usually used to in the commercial sector are about $20, $30, but some of these life preservers, depending on where you go, can cost $50 or more, some as much as $100, and that depends on the quality of the life preserver as well. Councilman Welch still feels this law is important, even though the recent drownings that she cites, many of them did not occur at public waterways that were navigable. Some of them happened at hotels or private resorts, but she still says this law is important to protect children and that this is what public safety officials and law enforcement officers need to do their job better.
All right, thanks, Philip. This is State of the News on WFPL, and right now we're discussing Metro News with our WFPL news team. Give us a call if you have some thoughts on some of the stories that have developed this week or that are on your mind. 502-814-8255. That's 502-814-TALK or 1-877-814-TALK. That's 8255. You can also email us at news at WFPL.org. We're on Twitter, WFPL News, and you can visit us on Facebook. Erica Peterson, a hearing this week that you covered regarding the class action suit against Zeon Chemicals by residents of Louisville's Butchertown neighborhood. What was that about?
It's actually Rubbertown, Rick.
I'm sorry, Rubbertown. Excuse me.
That was basically something that's been in play for a while. There have been several different settlement agreements that have been scrapped, and this is the newest one. And basically, it's a fairness hearing, and what that is exactly what it sounds like. It doesn't sound like a technical term, but it actually is, and it's where a settlement has to be approved by a judge. So you go before the judge, and both sides are, you know, trying to convince the judge that this settlement is fair. Now, this one had a little bit of a twist to it because, a settlement implies that both sides have agreed on this And that's the case between Zeon and the people who are named in this lawsuit. But there's an intervener as well who does not think this is fair. And that was community activist Ebony Neal Cochran. She was represented by Tom Fitzgerald of the Kentucky Resources Council. So it had a little bit of a twist where the lawyers for Zeon Chemical and the plaintiffs are on the same side. And Mr. Fitzgerald was arguing against them, basically.
So what's the next step? What happens next?
Well, the judge will decide whether the settlement is fair or not. And what the settlement is if you live within a mile of the Zeon plant, you get up to $750. If you live within 1 to 2 miles, you get up to $100. But there's a lot of stuff associated with that. You give up your right to sue for personal damages for a while, things like that, which is what some people object to. So I guess we'll hear in the next 7 days whether it's fair or not. If the judge decides it's not fair, they're basically back to square one with us.
All right. Thanks, Erica. Gabe, back over to you. There was a meeting this week to discuss development possibilities on South 4th Street, parts of which we affectionately refer to as the Whig block, talking about between Muhammad Ali and Broadway.
Yeah, the Whig district. Or whatever you want to call it.
Wig shops and radio stations.
Yeah, that's a lot of what's on 4th Street now.
Ours.
Exactly. We are right here. I can see 4th Street from where I sit. Anyway, there is a plan to develop this block, or these two blocks between Broadway and Muhammad Ali on 4th Street. This is something that came up even during the mayoral race in how to connect a lot of the developments north of here, downtown, 4th Street Live, which is directly to the north, and then some of the Market Street, Main Street developments, the arena area, with Broadway, and to just make sure there's one corridor through the city of development. So the Downtown Development Corporation commissioned a study of retail downtown. It found that there's about $200 million or so that could be spent that isn't being spent by people who work downtown, by hotel guests, people who, and the fewer people who do live downtown. So they commissioned the study, they found that out, and then they commissioned the man who had done that study to figure out a way to improve that, to fix that. He suggested that 4th Street get four retail anchors, an upscale movie theater that would have more comfortable seats, no children allowed. They compared it to a white tablecloth sort of restaurant of movie theaters. An entertainment venue, something they said along the lines of a House of Blues, but not necessarily a chain, not necessarily that chain, where there would be food served and there would be musical performances, a small or medium-sized venue. Then there would also be an arts co-op sort of location, and the other, a recording studio. It's the one that always slips my mind. And they say that those four would be able to anchor the area along with the hotels that are here and the existing theaters, the Palace Theater, the restaurants that are already down here. And that would lure in a lot of smaller or independent businesses. It's not going to compete, they say, with the Center City development that Cordish is planning, an extension of 4th Street Live, essentially, that would bring in some chain retail, some essentially more mall-type shops. They say that they don't necessarily want to compete with the mall with this 4th Street development, but it is an area that's closer than a lot of the shopping centers for a lot of residents of Louisville, people living to the west and immediate south, east, and even further east of downtown before you get into the St. Matthews area. It's a more convenient drive. A lot of people are down here during the week anyway. They want to lure them down here during the weekend, keep them down here after work. In regards to the Whig district, the Whig area, and those shops, they say there's no plan to push those businesses out. The plan doesn't call for any existing businesses to be relocated. However, they are in talks with some of the building owners. They're in talks with some of the business owners here about what would be best for all of the spaces, for the entire area. I talked with the DDC director, Alan DeLisle, and he said they don't want anyone to feel pushed out. They don't want anyone to actually be pushed out. But it's one of those things that happens as a city is developed, as an area is developed, the storefronts that exist do change over time. So maybe those business owners would want to change what they're doing. Maybe they, if they own the space, they would want to lease it to someone else. But that's not something the DDC is considering right now, he says. And he cited, there's a city in North Carolina, I forget what it is, but he said he worked there briefly, and going downtown, there were a number of wig shops in their developed area next to other shops, and no one really seemed to care.
Been a focus of discussion for many years now here on 4th Street.
Yeah, it has. It's
eager to see what happens. All right. Thanks, Gabe Bullard, and thanks to the rest of our Metro News team here at WFPL for joining us in our first segment of our program. Gabe Bullard, Erica Peterson, Devin Katayama, and Philip Bailey is going to stick around for our next segment to talk about the election. I also want to point out that Philip Bailey will be on live television tonight, KET, on Comment on Kentucky, right?
Yes, sir.
That's at 8 o'clock Eastern time?
Yes.
All right. We will see you then. And we'll be back with more in a moment. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Hallett. We turn our attention now to the 2011 election, the general election for statewide offices, the Kentucky governor and the other down-ticket offices we'll talk about shortly. Joining us to talk about that is Joe Girth from the Courier-Journal. Welcome back, Joe.
Hey, thanks so much.
And Philip Bailey is stuck around to talk about that. Philip, of course, is a WFPL political editor. Well, Joe, first of all, a new poll out that gives Steve Beshear a big lead over David Williams.
Yeah, a couple new polls out, in fact. A couple days ago, Public Policy Polling came out with a poll that showed Beshear ahead by 27 points. And then this morning, CN2, the Insight Cable political site, came out with their own poll that showed Beshear up 29. So we're starting to see some numbers that look an awful lot alike, and they're looking like they're awful big numbers for David Williams to come back.
What's been the Williams campaign response to this?
You know, their response is what you would expect, that it's still early in the election. We've got 2 months left. The only poll that matters is one taken on election day. You know, pick out your cliche, use it here. And it's the same thing. If I were them, I'd be saying the same thing. I mean, that's what you have to say, and you have to keep trying to put up a good face at this time. But I can't imagine it's a fun campaign right now.
No, I wouldn't think so. Philip, you talked earlier this week with someone from Kentucky Tea Party about all this, and they're a little disillusioned with Williams, it seems.
Yeah, I talked to David Adams, who ran Senator Rand Paul's campaign during the primary, and ran former gubernatorial candidate Phil Moffitt's campaign. He says that basically one of the reasons why you see these polls the way they are is that Tea Party advocates are not really enthusiastic about David Williams. They don't see him as one of their ideological brethren. They really see this race as two establishment candidates, and they're sort of just sitting on the sidelines at this point. Like Joe said earlier, I think that these poll numbers certainly can't be used to engender any support for Williams. At the end of the day, you're right. I mean, what the results are on election day are the only poll that really matters, but you certainly can't go to a fundraiser saying, well, we're down by 30 points. It certainly doesn't raise any sort of energy for the campaign. Also, it's having a negative effect, I believe, on down-ticket Republican candidates, because they have to certainly worry about the lack of turnout if your top of the ticket is so weak.
Joe, I'm just asking you to assume here, assuming Beshear goes on to victory over Williams, how does this hurt Williams' standing as state Senate president?
Well, that's a real question. That's a lot of what you're hearing talk about these days is when you look back at the history of legislative leaders who have run for higher office and done very poorly. You've seen it impact them. Jody Richards ran poorly in the 2007 Democratic primary. He was gone within 3 years as the House Speaker. You saw the same thing happen to Eck Rose when he ran for governor back in 1995, finished third in the Democratic primary, and within a year he was gone. Or actually, that's backwards. Eck lasted 3 years. Jody was gone within a year. So it's what generally happens is other legislators look at what happened to their leader in these elections, and they start questioning whether they have got the body going in the right direction, and mm-hmm. if whether or not voters like what's going on, and they start to see themselves losing like that if they ever choose to run for higher office, and they decide it's time to change direction. So that's a risk that Williams has. Whether or not that affects him that way, it's hard to tell. He has had a lot of support in that caucus in the past years, and he could be the one to kind of buck the trend, so to speak.
Is there someone in the wings in the Republican-controlled Senate that would succeed? Who would succeed Williams? That's looking for it.
There are several people out there who you hear mentioned. Julie Denton has considered a run against Williams in the past. Robert Stivers is the caucus leader. You would expect the floor leader. You'd expect him to possibly make a run. Another person who gets a lot of talk is Senator Tom Jensen of London, who mm-hmm. Has a lot of support. And he's seen as a moderate, someone who can work with both sides. So It really depends on what direction the caucus would want to go, or would they want to stick with Williams, which, again, is a distinct possibility.
We're talking with Joe Gerth from the Courier-Journal and Philip Bailey from WFPL about the general election, the gubernatorial race, and other statewide races coming up in November. We welcome your comments and calls at 502-814-8255, 502-814-TALK, or 877-814-TALK. At WFPL. Let's talk about some of these other races. Are there any really close races at this point, Philip, in the down ticket?
Well, the polling shows, if you look at the other down tickets, I think it's, you see about a 9 to 11 point margin on the other races, except for the Attorney General race, which a lot of Republicans have turned their attention to, considering how poorly Senator Williams is performing in the polls. In that race, you generally see Jack Conway, the incumbent Democratic Attorney General, performing very well, beating, I think, top people by around 18 points. The People campaign will point out that, you know, Attorney General Conway just finished running a U.S. Senate race. That a lot of that is name recognition. But there's a lot of Republican energy around Ty People's race, particularly attention and support from U.S. Senator Mitch McConnell. Larry Cox, one of his former advisors, is the chairman of People's campaign. You've seen Senator McConnell do a number of fundraisers for Mr. People. And also, you know, Ty People has attracted some national Republicans, not only the attorney general from Virginia, but former Arkansas governor and presidential candidate Mike Huckabee are planning on coming to Kentucky to both fundraise and campaign for People. So that race, I think, is becoming the silver lining for a lot of Republican consultants and voters. The other races are still pretty close, only because you haven't really seen any advertisements from them since the primary. A lot of those names have been forgotten. I think, for example, the Secretary of State race is still within 9 points. I know one campaign that certainly has to be disappointed probably in the poll numbers has to be that of Adam Edelin, a Democrat running for state auditor, considering that he was considered to be pummeling John Kemper, who has his own personal financial problems, while running for state auditor. That poll, I think, even CN2 put that poll at like about 3% for Edelin. So that certainly isn't encouraging for him. But once again, he hasn't run any ads yet. So we will see when these people get on TV and on the radio if those numbers change at all.
Joe, back to the governor's race for a moment. Are there going to be any more debates with Beshear and Williams?
Oh, yeah, there will be a couple. There will be one of the KET debates will go off as planned, and there's one in Richmond that's gonna happen. I doubt there's gonna be too many more than those two, though. Beshear is kind of playing the four corners offense. He's backed the ball out. He's not wanting to take any shots, and he's just trying to protect the lead that he's got right now. So,
what about the lieutenant governor candidates? How's Jerry Abramson been received out in the state thus far?
You know, I have not been out and around with him very much. When I went out with him back month and a half ago, he tended to be received pretty well where he was going. Now, he was going to Democratic crowds where you would expect them to receive him well. But obviously, if you look at the poll numbers, and the fact that he's from Louisville, maybe the fact that he is Jewish in a state with very few rural Jewish voters, is not hurting Beshear out in the state at this point. He's, I couldn't imagine Beshear with a 27-29 point lead if Abramson was hurting him. You have to wonder what that margin would be Abramson weren't on the ticket if there was a drive, but you know, you just don't see it.
Yeah, I think we have to also remember when Abramson first ran for mayor. I mean, he is a retail politician. He still knows how to shake the hands, kiss the babies. Also, if we look at some of the crosstabs in the PPP survey, what we see is that Richie Farmer's high negatives are actually higher than Abramson's. That could, you know, and many thought that in the ticket between David Williams and Richie Farmer, that Farmer was going to be the more likable of the two. I think the Williams campaign will certainly point out that is due in large part to some of the articles you've seen about Richie Farmer and his divorce. You haven't really seen the same sort of attention on Abramson and his record as mayor of Louisville, but I think we can't underestimate that Jerry Abramson knows how to get out there and campaign. While he was certainly mayor for life here in Louisville, he certainly knows how to do that basic politicking out in the rest of the state.
And finally, you talked to Richie Farmer recently about all this publicity with his divorce and whatnot. He seems to be a little frustrated by it.
Yes, very frustrated. Mr. Farmer, obviously, the news of his divorce has been in the news for past several months. His wife filed for divorce in the midst of the campaign. Mr. Farmer has said that he has asked the media to back off as much as possible, but that hasn't happened. It's really not clear if that's having as much negative impact on him as the fact that, you know, Farmer has been in a seat where he certainly has a lot of high approval ratings and during these elections, but he really hasn't been campaign tested. I think that we all sort of see that he's a bit green when it comes to some of these more hardcore campaigns.
Well, and one thing that you have to also consider is it may not be the news that deals with his divorce that's mattering, but it's the news that deals with his purchase of automobiles, mm-hmm. his purchase of
a refrigerator.
Mm-hmm. Just a number of stories have come out over the past few months that the Democrats argue show that he is not a good steward of taxpayer money, and that has got to be hurting, especially when he's running on a ticket with Williams, who the Tea Party doesn't believe he will be a good steward of taxpayer money.
So, yeah, I think it shows that Farmer is not used to this level of scrutiny. Agriculture Commissioner is one of those seats in which the media doesn't pay really that much attention to you when you're in office. But now that you're running for the second spot, top spot in the state, he is certainly getting more scrutiny than he's used to.
All right. Thanks to Joe Girth and Philip M. Bailey talking about the general election coming up for Kentucky governor and other statewide offices. When we come back, we'll talk about instant racing with Greg Hall of the Courier-Journal. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Hallett. Well, this week, a racetrack in southern Kentucky became the first in the state to install the instant racing game. It allows bettors to wager on videos of previously run horse races. Opponents say it constitutes illegal gambling. And here to talk to us about it is Greg Hall of the Courier-Journal. Welcome back.
Hi.
I think this might be your first time with us.
Yeah. Maiden voyage.
Well, welcome to WFPL. Glad to have you. You've been, of course, covering this story. First of all, exactly what is instant racing? What happens when you play this game?
If you walk up to it, it looks just like a slot machine. It's a video slot machine. There's not mechanical spinning reels, but the graphics mimic that. You can walk up to it, put your money in, hit a couple buttons, and the machine would play like a slot machine, and you find out if you win or not. The other way to play it is put your money in, and it's based off of old horse races. Whether you win or not, and you don't know the identity of the horse race, but you can get some basic handicapping information that doesn't identify anything, but it might be trainer record at track in last year. And it's a pie chart, and if the one horse in the 10-horse field was the most successful, had the most successful trainer, then his pie chart would be the biggest, and you might punch his number. You punch three numbers, or you can get some handicapping helper. There's a button that gives you suggestions there too. Then you hit start and you find out if you won or not. The only thing you see of the horse race is about 3 seconds in the top right hand of the screen while the other traditional slot machine looking graphics play out elsewhere.
I see. Is this a popular game elsewhere?
It's been successful in Arkansas where it's in use at Oaklawn Park and a Greyhound track outside of near Memphis. And, you know, the Oaklawn folks credit it with saving Oaklawn when Louisiana had expanded gambling and they started to lose horses and patrons to Louisiana. And they also had the effects of Tunica, Mississippi's casinos. But, you know, in a place like Simpson County, where it sits on the Tennessee border and Tennessee only has a lottery, this might be Kentucky's best shot at instant racing, making a significant contribution. Churchill Downs here in Louisville, you know, they take a more deliberative view. I don't know what the right word is there, but they are not as convinced that in a more advanced gambling market like Louisville, where you have casinos on the Ohio River, you know, both in both directions, that players will come and play the game as much as they would a regular slot machine. I mean, there are some differences to it that, you know, you can walk up to a slot machine, and if you want to think it out, it's pretty hard to think it out. You just hit the button or pull the lever and go.
Mm-hmm.
This, there are more steps involved. If you want to do that. And that takes some getting used to, and that's probably why they're not as lucrative as a traditional slot machine.
So instant racing was actually approved by the Kentucky Racing Commission to be implemented at tracks here, but it's also being tested in the courts, correct?
Right. There is when the Racing Commission approved the rules last July, at the same time the commission and the tracks filed a lawsuit just to have a court declare the make sure that the law is legal or that the game is legal before you know, people went to the expense. Kentucky Downs decided to do it anyway before the court case is ultimately decided. But a Franklin Circuit Court judge last December said it is pari-mutuel gambling because you're betting against other players playing at the same time rather than against the house as in a traditional slot machine. And the Family Foundation of Kentucky intervened. They say it is a slot machine and therefore is illegal. And they appealed the circuit court ruling to the Court of Appeals, and that could be months away before that's decided.
And Kentucky Downs just started using the games this week, correct?
They opened up on Thursday, and you know, they did very little marketing by design because they wanted to get the kinks not worked out before, you know, big crowds mm-hmm. came. They wanted to get it up and running before their meet starts on September 10th, which is when they would have some of their bigger crowds. And I think the real marketing of it in Tennessee and around the region will come probably after their meet.
All right. Greg Hall with the Courier-Journal. Thanks for joining us, and we hope to have you back. Welcome to the program.
Thanks.
All right. We turn our attention now to the art world. Leo Weekly has a cover story this week about a Louisville artist who has admitted to claiming another artist's work, in this case, a painter's work, as his own. And joining us to talk about it is the author of that story, Carrie Stemley. Welcome back, Carrie.
Thanks, Rick.
Well, tell us, who is this artist and how did all this come to light?
Well, the person who claimed the work is named Jim Mahanes, and the work that was claimed wrongly was by Jim Cantrell, who's been an artist for 50-some-odd years. He's based in Bardstown. Mm-hmm. Cantrell had painted a still life of a raincoat with a scarf maybe in 1977, and it donated it, they think, to an auction and hadn't thought much about it. And recently their daughter, Vanita, who lives here in Louisville, was over at the Highlands Art Studios where Jim Mahanes had space and noticed this painting and just realized it looked a lot like one she had seen. So she started to talk to her mom about it, and eventually they substantiated that it was, in fact, a painting that Cantrell did in 1977. And so they looked, they had the coating on the back and everything, and I guess Mr. Mahanes had picked it up somewhere from a friend who had gotten it somewhere and it had been a little damaged, and he had basically painted out Cantrell's signature and had it hanging up as if he had painted it.
Mm. And there was this dramatic confrontation with Cantrell and
Yes, once Mahanes. They figured out what had happened, they came to the studio there in the Highlands on the night they knew he would be there, and they nervously confronted him. And initially, I think Mr. Mahanes kind of tried to equivocate, and the next day he called and acknowledged it and apologized, and has apologized to them a number of times subsequently. And I guess there's also a painting in there by a painter that looked like one named James Foose, who the Cantrells knew from Lexington. He was a UK art professor and a painter, and the Cantrells have run a gallery over the years, and they used to sell Foose's work, so they knew that one. And they have a question about that one as well. Mr. Mahanes tells me that he just painted a copy because he knows Foose as well and painted a copy. Mm-hmm. And admits that he's maybe been a little looser with copying other people's work without attributing it, as I've learned that you really need to do in the art world.
Now, is this a criminal offense, or will there be charges?
Well, some suggest that, you know, some laws have been broken, but it doesn't seem like the Cantrells really want to pursue it in that angle, and the police, I think it's a fairly low level in terms of how much money might be involved, and so it doesn't look like anything's going to happen. I think, you know, some attorneys I talked to said they do think there was a crime, but you know, they're not like Andy Warhol, where there's hundreds of thousands of dollars involved, so maybe it's just not going to make any sense financially to go that route.
This raises a lot of questions about various copyright protections. I don't know much about the visual art world, but from what I understand, it's not unusual for a painter to recreate another artist's work just as an exercise, I guess, more or less. But
yeah,
you got to be clear about
it. And I'm like you, Rick. I don't live in that world per se. So, of course, you call somebody who does. And I talked with John Begley at U of L, and he was like, really the accepted thing to do. I mean, it's fine to paint, say, an Andrew Wyeth painting to learn how to do it. The teacher, Mahanes teaches as well, and he uses it as an exercise. But if you're going to display it and try to sell it, you need to say something like after Andrew Wyeth, you know, clearly, right. You know, Starry Night or whatever. Even though everybody knows Van Gogh painted it, you can't just paint your own version and hang it up. That's kind of, and as I said in the story, the art world's fairly self-policing, and so the reaction's been pretty brutal here. You know, some people in the art world that I've talked to are pretty up in arms about this.
And just in a few seconds, a quick answer. Mahane's still in business, or is he still painting?
Well, he says he's not going to quit painting. He's not sure where. You know, he's very contrite. I think he feels mortified. He admits that, you know, he was just a little insecure. And I should say here that, you know, a number of people say that he's talented in his own right. You know, he's got his own style, and he's done a lot of good work. And so it's just a little confusing as to why. And he just sort of admits that it was insecurity and ego.
All right. The name of the article is Art of Deception. It's in Leo Weekly this week, and the author is Carrie Stemley. Thanks for joining us, Carrie.
My pleasure, Rick. Thanks.
That's all the time we have for today's program. For more information about topics discussed on today's program, visit WFPL.org. And State of Affairs is produced by the WFPL News staff, our production team led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. I'm Rick Howlett. Have a good weekend. All right.